Hi, this is Andy Herman, producer of Outside the Loop Radio. Here's a clip from our audio archives available at OutsideTheLoopRadio.com with host Mike Steven.
So here we are on the near west side of Chicago, very close to the United Center, and I'm sitting here with Johnny Savory. And Johnny, it's nice to talk to you. You have quite the story to tell, and it starts roughly 30, 32 years ago. When you were 14 years old, you were convicted of a double homicide, weren't you?
Yes.
And what exactly happened?
Well, on January 25th, I went to school as I always do.
This is 77?
Yeah, 1977. Mm-hmm. 14 years old. While in school, the principal of the school came to the classroom, asked me to proceed with him to the conference room, the teacher's conference room. And there, he introduced me to two detectives. And they asked me about the death of my friend and his sister, James Robinson and Connie Cooper. I told the officers I didn't know anything. They tried to tell me, did I see anything the day before the murder? That's the reason that they came to me. The murder took place on January 18th. I was with them on January 17th. And they asked me, what did I remember about the 17th? What all took place? I told them that. And then they just continued on. I don't know why they felt as though I knew something that I did not know, because I never seen them again after the 17th. They asked me to come and go with them to the police station. I went with them, asked them, could I talk to my dad? They told me that he would be there. He never came because they lied. I found out later that they lied to my dad and told him that they would be bringing me home that day. They never brought me home. They told me I was free to leave, but they never allowed me to leave. And they just continued to ask me question after question after question. I was tired, wanted to go home, hadn't eaten. And they kept me from like 3 o'clock in the evening to like, I guess at least 10:30 p.m. That night on January 25th.
And you're 14 years old down in Peoria.
Yes. And I just never had been through nothing like this, so I never had no problems with law enforcement. I was where I was supposed to be. I was in school, and it was just, I don't know, it was like a bad dream developing, and it just was unreal. And from there, they took me to the polygraph examiner's office. Polygraph lasted for about an hour and 15 minutes. We left there by about 11:30 p.m. Took me to the juvenile detention center for juveniles. And they told me I would stay there overnight, and then they would let me go home in the morning. Instead, they came back and got me that morning at 8 o'clock. Interrogations began all over again. I wasn't allowed to see my dad till about 10 o'clock. By that time, it was so chaotic and so confusing. He was only angry. He didn't know what was going on. And I was just confused, didn't know what to say, didn't know what to do, didn't know who to turn to. And it just kept proceeding downhill. And they took me into the officer's washroom, where they stripped me of all my clothes, took hair samples from all parts of my body. And I just was drifting. I was losing my will slowly, but surely my will was dissipating. But I didn't know it. I just wanted what was taking place with me to stop. It didn't stop. It's just more interrogations. I became angry, so I just started to say anything just for them to leave me alone. And they took me back to the polygraph examiner. It was about 7:30 p.m. that night. Polygraph examiner, different one this time. He just became just irate. He was calling me a murderer. He called me a liar. He was just... And the tears began to flow from my eyes because Nobody never done nothing like that to me before. You know, no adult, no. I never experienced what I was going through. And it just went downhill. The officer came in. I didn't want to no longer talk to the polygraph examiner, so we never finished that polygraph examination. Officer Martella Tiblets, which is Marcella Brown, that's two names she go by. She came in, and instead of dealing with the polygraph examiner for the abuse that he was inflicting, I didn't realize at the time that they were looking at it. You know, they were watching me through whatever, two-way glass or what have you. But they knew what he was doing and had done to me. And I said, okay, I did it. Just, can I go home? And they said, no. And then she began to word me along with, okay, well, this happened at the scene, this happened. And I disagreed.
They basically wore you down to the point where you would say anything.
Yeah, I couldn't know. I had lost my will. And then maybe about 60 seconds, the confession lasts about 60 seconds. And I somehow regained my strength back and my composure, because they wanted me to sign the confession, and I wouldn't sign it, and then, or to write one out, and I wouldn't write one out. And so they became upset, and then they took me and placed me in juvenile custody. I never got a chance to see a juvenile judge. They placed me in custody on January 26th, and also they never read me my rights, never once. So they never let me see my dad until the next day. They never read me any Miranda rights. They never took me before a judge in 36 hours. They took me into custody January 26th. I didn't see a judge until juvenile judge until February 4th, the following month.
So eventually, then you were convicted of a double homicide, and you were 14 years old.
Yes, they convicted me solely on the confession. There was no other evidence in the case whatsoever. Although they did have a pair of pants belonging to my father with type A blood on them. My father was about 250 pounds, 5'10". He had an accident a week before the murder. All of his clothes had his blood on them. And the officers that took the pants told the state's attorney and the chief of police that Savory couldn't have wore those pants because they're too big for him. I was only 5 feet tall, maybe 110 pounds. But they didn't listen to that. And they deceived the jury by folding the pants up on the desk, making it look as though the pants could have fit me. And as for the blood type, one of the victims, Connie Cooper, her blood type was A positive. My dad's blood was A negative. So they removed the pluses and the negatives from the blood type, the blood grouping, in order to cast the illusion that the blood on the pants belonged to one of the victims.
So there's just, I mean, a combination of bad timing, shoddy investigative work, and corrupt investigative work, as well as essentially police torture.
Yes, yes. It was unreal because meeting with Officer Friendly growing up in the neighborhood and all the things that they had told me, and no doubt there are some very good officers out there who love their job, who love their profession, as well as prosecutors and judges. However, these particular ones here, we're only talking about a few people who really didn't care about what they were doing and didn't care about me as a human being. So therefore, they just, I guess, saw a way to maybe boost their careers or do whatever reason they had. I don't know particularly what their reasons were. All I know is they took me from school, they took me from my home, and they wrecked my entire life.
Yeah. Talking with Johnny Savory here on Outside the Loop Radio on WLUW. So, Johnny, you essentially, from age 14, for the next 30 years, you grew up in prison. What prison were you in?
Oh, I was in Stateville, Pontiac, various prisons throughout the state of Illinois, as well as coming out of juvenile, you know, maximum security for that. But it was on trial, the first trial, that the state's attorney tried to give me the death penalty at 14 years old. I would have been the youngest in American history to receive the death penalty. But thank God he didn't allow that to take place. He tried hard, and when I returned at age 17, he tried to give me the death penalty again. And it's amazing that despite all the evidence that showed that I was innocent, And right now today, the witnesses they used in the second trial, they had no witnesses in the first trial. And at the same time that the witnesses that they used who recanted their testimony, they knew that I was with at school, with Percy Baker Jr., with Sherman Jones. At the time, these witnesses said I was with them, and all those are state employees. And that's what's amazing. They knew they were lying, and they still... They didn't allow the jury to hear this, so I don't pretty much blame the jury. You know, people always ask me why I didn't have my lawyers pursue the fact that they picked the jury pool in the first trial from 300 whites and the first second time from 50. Because to me, it wasn't about racism in my case more than it was about a system that was broken and needed reform desperately, because we come out of a very dark time in our country. And it was looking at the Emmett Till story that allowed me to understand my situation. Emmett Till was 14 years old, so was I. He was born July 25th, so was I. And he had a bubbly disposition, so did I. And it was amazing that... that we had came so far, but yet we still was in a time that people could be still be so cruel to children as we see today, you know. And my life meant nothing. And it was just a nightmare that I wanted to end, you know. Whether that sent me home or wherever it sent me, it just didn't matter, because I couldn't believe what was happening to me.
30 years in prison. So fast forward then to 2006, mm-hmm. where when Northwestern University got a hold of your case.
Oh, I got to take you before then.
Oh, take me before then?
Before then, I was able to have correspondence with the late Honorable Prentice Marshall, one of the most awesome federal judges in our state history. And He allowed me to communicate with him, and that's a rare thing that often never happens, but that's how much compassion that he had on the bench. Now, when I began to correspond with him, he was just in arbitration, sitting in arbitration cases, but he was a retired senior federal judge, and he responded like a human being, and he went over my case, and he said what happened here was wrong. I kept all his letters, and he contacted his old law firm, which is Jenner and Block. They in return took up my case and began to unravel this web of lies and fabrication of evidence. They subsequently filed a clemency for me, and finally I had attorneys that would do what I asked and would look at the evidence and not push it aside.
What year was this?
This was, oh God, my clemency was filed in 2003 or 4, and it still is on the governor's desk as we speak for actual innocence. I believe the governor, based on his promise in the Cruz case, that he said he would never allow these such tragedies like this to ever happen again. So I believe that any day now he would sign my clemency and grant DNA testing. The DNA testing is not for me to prove my innocence. The DNA testing is to solve the crime itself and also just further show that the prosecutors did lie in my particular case, but the evidence of my innocence is already set before him. The people have recanted their testimony. The hairs under the victim's fingernails did not match mine. There's just a whole host of evidence already there that he could grant clemency tomorrow or today. But I want it all. I want to show the people of Peoria, as well as all the people that supported me all these years, just what they've already know and what they've already seen. They know the truth. And but Governor Wilders, he said in the Cruz case that all the legal experts agreed that Cruz was railroaded. Well, he should take a look at my case today, and he will see from Thomas P. Sullivan, one of the most dynamic U.S. attorneys in our state's history, Dan K. Webb, Samuel Skinner, as well as all the people at Northwestern, And all throughout the country, even Canada, with Dr. Hurricane Carter, he will see that they all agree that this shouldn't have never took place. But back to Northwestern, it was meeting Steve Drizin that really, and Rob Warden, that really brought me home now. And I remember Steve Drizin coming to see me, and he said, just get ready, and I'm going to bring you home. Because I had really pretty much given up on the parole board, even though there was a new parole board there. And one of the people that was on the board, former Senator, State Senator Johnson, Tom Johnson, he said, Johnny, give us a chance. And I really didn't believe. After 25 times of going and being told no because I was innocent, and they wanted me to say something or do something to take away the guilt from the prosecutors and Peoria police, and I just wasn't going to do that, you know. And so Steve brought me home December 19, 2006.
You were a free man.
Yes.
And where you're at right now is, as you said, you want to get your name cleared completely. This is on Governor Blagojevich's desk. He could do this today. He could do this tomorrow.
Yes. And I prefer him to go and do it today, because you don't need to, we need to wait no longer, because we've already waited like 3 years for my clemency been sitting up there. And you have, I think, maybe about 25 other clemencies sitting up there. Now, we're not talking about people asking for a second chance. I'm not asking for a second chance. Give me the chance that I deserve. You know, if justice and truth is truly what our Constitution stands for, what our Bill of Rights stand for, and what he stands for as the oath he took in office, then he should go ahead and grant, and his lawyers and all the people that are around him, and I know he's a very busy person, he had the budget to deal with and various other things, but innocent people's lives at stake right here in our state. And as for Barack, too, you know, I don't want this to solely rest on the governor's shoulder. And it shouldn't be, no governor or no state official should be made to feel as though when they undo the wrongs of our past that somehow or another the voters are unhappy, because that is so twisted and so warped to even conceive that in your mind. That is what made us grow as a nation, is the fact that we can undo our wrongs and admit them. How do we tell our children to obey the law and do the things they're supposed to do when we, as adults, they neglect the accountability and refuse to use the integrity and honor that they went in office on?
Yeah. And we should get about the governor's phone number.
Yes.
You could call him and say, order the DNA testing for Johnny Savory.
Yes.
217-782-0244. That's 217-782-0244. That's Governor Blagojevich's phone number. Yes. Also, the website online, justiceforsavory.windycitizen.com. And Savory spelled S-A-V-O-R-Y, justiceforsavory.windycitizen.com. It's also a Facebook group as well. Johnny, finally, you've spent 30 years in prison. You've gone through this tremendous ordeal. You don't seem like a bitter man. How is that? How are you not bitter?
Well, I can only contribute to my faith in God and all the wonderful people that he has sent me and continues to send me every day, such as John Mackey, you, Jonathan Jackson, Rob Warden, Norma Adams, Kenny Adams, Joy, all the many wonderful people, my God, such as Sandra and Eva, all these wonderful people, even being here at St. Leonard's Ministry with Bob Doherty, with my administrator David Rosa, James Hanson. I could name all the people, Dolores Kennedy at Northwestern, my attorneys over at Jen and Block, Chris and Barry Sheck, Peter Newfield, all these people from Canada, the United States, have rallied around me. So I haven't had to suffer the hardship that many other people have suffered in my position coming home. It's almost unbelievable as my story, as the people that have continued to come into my life. So it's almost like it's a new journey, because let's face it, up until the last 20 years, you really, being innocent in prison meant nothing. You know, you still treated like everyone else. When you got out, they gave you nothing. So I'm happy to see the reform that has taken place in Illinois, because Illinois is probably one of the leading states that do to some type of compensation for the people that they have wronged and given a chance. But I would still like him to look into giving some other people jobs. We shouldn't have to go and stand in the employment line. We stood in that when you stayed in prison for something we didn't do. So, you know, that's the remarkable thing about this. You know, I'm not here to destroy our system. I'm here to make it better. And the only way we can make it better is we have to use, you know, our intellect, our love, and no doubt I've been through my moments, you know, and anger, bitterness, and those things are only like cancerous. So it would have robbed me from the rest of my life. And I couldn't allow, I'm not a victim. I don't act like no victim. I'm a warrior, and that's how I act. And many people that went through my situation, men and women, both, I just consider them are warriors, you know, because it takes a lot, and for their families, you know. And for you all, thank God for the drum majors, whether they're in media or what, especially the media. The media has done so much for situations like ours. Without them, with the investigative reporters, Sun-Times, I just went before the editorial board, which was very beautiful. They gave me much love there, and they're working on my story, the Tribune. So I've had help at every stage of my life. And, you know, I want that same help for those other people out there that are in the same situation I am. I don't want them to get lost in that 1,800 clemency that's on the governor's desk.
Well, this is an incredible story. You are an incredible man. Thank you for sitting down with me and sharing your story with all of us. I know it's very emotional for you. Again, justiceforsavory.windycitizen.com. Johnny Savory, thanks so much for your time.
And I want to tell everybody that this Saturday on September the 13th, we have a Truth and Justice Summit out at Operation Push, which will be headed by Jonathan Jackson. And since I've been home, that's another person that has helped me tremendously, whether it's with dental, clothes, all these things. Like I said, I have so many wonderful people around me. I'm so blessed. And it just keep growing, you know. And that's the blessed thing about being American and about the country we live in. You know, once the people are made known of the things that have taken place, they are very generous and comes to the aid of those other Americans that need help. And thank you.
Johnny, thanks so much for talking to us here on Outside the Loop.
Yes.
You've been listening to a clip from Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's Almost Above Ground audio magazine. For this clip, our audio archives, and complete shows, visit us at OutsideTheLoopRadio.com.